Now the three martini lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Jim Garrity is on vacation. Charlie Cook of National Review here in his place. He joins me by phone from Dallas, Texas today. The Three Martini Lunch going on the road, although something tells me Charlie might have a slightly different reason for joining us from there. Today we still have good news, bad news, and crazy news for you as conservatives, as always. Charlie, thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. The good news today is that while we're expecting very bad news either today or tomorrow in the U.S. Senate, when lawmakers there pass the Gang of Eight bill with the Corker-Hoven Amendment, we've established many different times why we're not happy with this bill. It's legalization first. We're not exactly sure what type of guarantee we really have on the border security. All sorts of problems with this bill. A lot of discretion left up to Janet Napolitano, which is never a good thing. But a lot of the fire has been on the Senate side because that's where the legislation exists right now. But over on the House side, a lot of conservatives have been pressuring John Boehner, do not take up anything that does not have majority Republican support in the House of Representatives. He's, for the most part, agreed to that. And now he's saying that this Senate bill is dead on arrival in the House. And even members like Paul Ryan, who would probably be favorable towards that legislation, say that's not going to happen either. So it doesn't mean that something bad won't eventually happen, but at least the bill that we're all holding our noses on right now will not see the light of day in and of itself in the House.
No, and I think that's by far and away the most important thing. The Senate has opponents of its bill in a bit of a bind at the moment because it can accuse them of being against immigration reform, or in some cases against immigration completely, which is something that greatly amuses me when people accuse me of hating immigrants because I am one. The reality is that the vast majority, I think, of opponents of this bill have problems with the bill. They don't have problems with immigrants, and they don't necessarily deny that immigration reform is necessary. And that would be immigration reform in the legal area as well, because the legal immigration system in this country is also broken and it's also out of date. What I'm hoping here is that Boehner can put together a bill that addresses the concerns of the opponents while including the aims of everybody, which is to try and find some way of fixing the border, then doing something with the people who have crossed it, and also modernizing the legal immigration system without importing millions and millions and millions of low-income workers into a bloated welfare state and into a country with economic problems. Possibly he should propose doing this piecemeal. I don't think anyone wants to see a sort of rival 1,000-page bill. And then he can push it back to the Senate and say, look, we're just as interested in immigration reform as you are, but this is how we want to do it. Don't obstruct it. This is the ball is in your court. Whether he will do that remains to be seen, but that's now the big hope.
Charlie, one of the concerns from some House conservatives is that even if the House passes something that's limited and very conservative, perhaps focused only on border security, if that goes to a conference, you're going to have at least some Senate Republicans still backing the Senate version of this bill, and ultimately whatever comes out of conference is going to look more like that legislation than anything the House sends over. And so then the House will end up being forced to vote on potentially a pretty bad bill. How concerned are you about that?
I think that is a serious problem, and that is really an argument in favor of letting this bill die and taking it up next year. I don't buy the idea that there is a huge rush to do this. There are certainly problems, but they're not problems that need to be fixed right this moment. There's not an imminent emergency. What was bad a year ago, 5 years ago, is also bad today. So I think you're right to be wary of the structure of the way this is done, because we don't want to find ourselves in some sort of, I mean, not literally, but in reconciliation situation where the Senate manages to get what it wants over the wishes of the House.
On to martini number two now. And Charlie, I think in addition to frustration over the contents of the bill, a lot of conservatives have been very frustrated specifically over Marco Rubio's role in this, especially after he talked in his campaign in 2010 about border security first. A lot of conservatives see him as compromising way too much on this issue. And as we head over to the House eventually taking up this issue, whether sooner or later, it seems like the Marco Rubio of the House is Paul Ryan, who was never really known for his stance on this issue, but he's pretty much standing shoulder to shoulder with Luis Gutierrez, who couldn't be more liberal on this issue. What do you make of Paul Ryan taking on this role, and what do you think it does to his stature if he stays where he is on this issue?
The parties have two different makeups on this question, in that the Democratic Party is largely united behind immigration reform of effectively any sort. I think it's fair to say that the Democratic Party would have voted, at least the vast majority of them would have voted for whatever bill came out of the Senate and whatever bill comes out of the House, as long as their leadership says okay. Whereas with the Republican Party, you have a genuine split down the middle. And so you have people, I know Rand Paul is opposing this bill in particular, but you have people like Rand Paul and Marco Rubio in the Senate, and you have people like Paul Ryan in the House. They're balancing the opportunity and growth and American dream side of it. But the same sort of instincts that led Ronald Reagan in 1986 to sign the amnesty bill then, and they're weighting that above the concerns that, well, we've been here before, that there's a problem in the order of this. And also, some of them, I think, are making the mistake of presuming that we live in the world that they would like to live in, where there isn't a big welfare state, and there isn't Obamacare, and there isn't all these problems. I think it's disappointing to see Paul Ryan make that judgment, but it's not just him. I mean, the Republican Party is sort of split on this. If you look at the what I would call the difference between the sort of Wall Street Journal editorial board and, say, National Review, is they're making a different judgment. Paul Ryan, who's always been a National Review kind of guy, has gone Wall Street Journal on us. So hopefully we can convince him that although his instincts are right, the details of the bill that is being put forward are not, and hope that he'll spearhead something more sensible.
Well, just watch cable news over the last few weeks, and you'll see this ad for support the Marco Rubio conservative immigration reform. They're just hammering the term conservative. I think it's a U.S. Chamber of Commerce ad, or at least they're partly sponsoring it. But they're definitely trying to make the case that where Rubio and Ryan are here is the conservative position on this issue. And obviously, as you've just pointed out, there's a fierce debate in the party about that. And forever from now on will be known as the Wall Street Journal versus National Review debate on immigration. So well done for couching the debate in those terms, Charlie. I'm sure your editors will be very happy about that. On to Martini number three now, Charlie. And people's attitudes towards Edward Snowden have vacillated widely over the past couple of weeks. Some people have hated him from the get-go for essentially breaking the law, which I don't think anybody really disagrees with that he did. Some saw it initially as a good thing so we could have the debate and we need to know about what the government is and isn't doing with our personal communications. But as time went on and he left and now he's potentially revealing more and more secrets and how we do intelligence work, people are getting much more skittish about him. The Obama administration, of course, has charged him now with espionage and other things, and they want to get him back. And at first, there was this fierce demand. We must have him. You must turn him over. We think he's in Russia now. Vladimir Putin heard that and said, yeah, we're not going to do that. So the very next day, John Kerry, who had been very vociferous and almost kind of puffing his chest about the dangers of not extraditing Snowden in Saudi Arabia on the 25th, says, well, we're just asking, we're not demanding, we're just hoping that we can reach an accommodation here, really dialing back the rhetoric. And now you have President Obama overseas in Africa at a joint press conference in Senegal with this approach.
I have not called President Xi personally or President Putin personally, and the reason is because, number one, I shouldn't have to. This is something that routinely is dealt with between law enforcement officials in various countries. And this is not exceptional from a legal perspective. No, I'm not going to be scrambling jets to get a 29-year-old hacker.
And so a couple points here, Charlie. First of all, it's pretty clear that Vladimir Putin and possibly the Chinese government as well, not very intimidated by anything the U.S. is throwing out there right now. And it's interesting how quickly Edward Snowden is supposedly not that big of a deal to this administration once they got that no answer.
Well, this is classic Obama, isn't it? It's the gap between the rhetoric and the action, the constant vacillation, as you've seen on Keystone, as you've seen on Syria. The weakness of American standing. I think perhaps people misunderstand what it is that conservatives object to in this area. Myself, I'm not a neoconservative. I don't want America invading everywhere. I'm not particularly sure how good our foreign policy was in the last 10 years. But, you know, when Ronald Reagan was president, he didn't really invade much of the world. He didn't act very often. when he did it with overwhelming force, so that next time anybody stepped out of line, he would be able to make a phone call and know that he would get his own way. Vladimir Putin is not scared of Barack Obama, and he's not scared of the United States. And so the president has no choice but to downplay this. I also wouldn't underestimate the degree to which the president is trying to play both sides of it in looking strong against leaks. He is harsh on leaks. Glenn Greenwald does have a point in the way that the White House punishes people whilst leaking itself. But he also has a base that many of whom very much like Edward Snowden and who are angry with him over the NSA issue. So I'm not sure he will scramble jets because he's got 3 years left. He's increasingly unpopular, and he probably doesn't have the power to do it anyway.
Yeah, we'll find out if Ed Snowden stays ensconced in the Moscow airport or wherever he is in perpetuity here. He's got to be getting pretty tired of hitting a couple different spots in the food court. I got to think he's getting a little tired of the routine at this point, Charlie. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, somebody the other day very amusingly pointed out that he's now playing Tom Hanks in The Terminal. He's found himself there for a month. I mean, look, this guy, I think from the beginning, did make a big mistake. And as you mentioned at the beginning, he has become increasingly erratic. I was really very unconcerned with Edward Snowden, qua Edward Snowden at the beginning. To me, the story was about NSA spying, and I repeatedly said, you don't have to like the guy in order to be worried about what it was that he had revealed. Now that he's in the service of another power, God knows what he did in China, God knows what he's doing in Russia, I think he is someone we should be a lot more concerned about. Really, if he were a whistleblower of the sort of moral stature that people are suggesting that he is, I would have advocated his standing in front of the White House, calling a press conference, saying what he said, and then being taken away in chains. He has put himself in this position. He did potentially have other avenues he could have gone down. He didn't take them. So I have very little sympathy for him. That doesn't mean we shouldn't be worried about what he revealed.
Yeah, we're assuming at this point that the reports are right, that he's still in the transit area of the airport. For all we know, he's at Russian intelligence nibbling on caviar while he spills all the beans. So we'll find out.
It is worrying. It is worrying.
Charlie, good to have you with us again. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Thank you. See you tomorrow.
Charlie Cook of National Review in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us again on Friday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.